Who can say where the killer roams? When the blood flows, it's slaying time. Slay away. Slay away. Slay away.
Slay Away, the podcast where we discuss the inspiration behind your favorite horror films, lore, gore, and every kill in between. Welcome, I'm E.L. King, and we're doing something different this month as we celebrate Femme Voices in Horror with a series of panels exploring different horror cinema topics with special guests. Today, we're going to be discussing and exploring the female hysteria myth, witchcraft, and folklore, and I have some really special guests here with me today. I'd like to introduce you to Jessica Scott. Jessica is a film critic, editor, and cosplayer who focuses on queer and feminist issues in horror. She's also a content editor for Film Cred. We also have Blaine Waterloo. Blaine is the host of Ladies in Ligaments, as well as an editor and contributor for Hear Us Scream, an online horror outlet. We have Lauren Lamel with us. Lauren is a horror-obsessed writer, producer, and creative based in the Bronx. Lauren is also the co-host of the Scary Crypt podcast. Lastly, but not least, Shannon Brown joining us today. Shannon is a podcaster and host of the This Will Scare You podcast, a horror and comedy writer and filmmaker. Her most recent short film, Demon Juice, is currently on the festival circuit. Welcome, everybody. I'm so excited you're here. Are you ready to chat horror with me today?
Heck yeah.
Hell yeah.
Yes.
Blaine, as a first-time guest, how did you discover your love of horror?
So, like many horror fans, I was just inundated with it from the get. I really don't remember a time that I wasn't watching horror. And having grown up in an abusive household, horror was really a reprieve, both literally and figuratively. So, you know, just like a whole lot of other femmes, horror is an outlet for, you know, exercising trauma and catharsis, but it's also just, it's just so much fun. I mean, where else can you see, where else can you laugh? Can you cry? Can you see blood and guts and all of the nudity? It's just the perfect package. So yeah, a lifetime horror fan forever and ever. Amen.
I laughed out loud. You didn't hear me when you said all of the nudity. Yes, exactly. All of the nudity also happens. I just watched a film that has plenty of gore, nudity, and like cool alien invasion stuff going on. Lauren, it's your first time as well. So how did you discover your love of horror?
It is. So it's actually, I was not super into it when I was younger. What happened was I have an older brother. He's 10 years older than me. And I think whenever you have older siblings like that, you get into stuff that you're not supposed to be into at your age. And he watched the Leprechaun movie, and it was him and his friend and me and my friend. And then I had to walk my friend home, and him and his friend scared us. And I was like, oh no, never again. This is not happening. So I watched, it was like, and those were like blockbuster days, right? So I rewound the tape and I watched it over and over and over again until I wasn't scared of it anymore. And then we went back to the Blockbuster to like take it back. And the guy at the counter was like, you know, there's like 8 of these. And I was like, what? So thank you, guy at the Blockbuster counter, for showing me that there was a world of horror at my disposal.
Well, Shannon, again, you're new as well. So how did you discover your love of horror?
Yeah, so I'm a late bloomer, you guys. I've always loved Halloween and like all spooky things. But as a kid and even as a teenager and even as an early adult, I was too scared of most horror movies. Like the closest I got, you know, was, I mean, I guess Chucky and like Bride of Chucky are pretty horror-ish. ish. But I had leaned into dark comedy my entire life, and coming up in comedy in Philly, everyone has a pretty dark sense of humor. So then I met my current boyfriend about 5 years ago, and he was a big horror freak, and he got me into it. And I was like, well, my dark comedy seems to work pretty well with gore, so here I am now.
And Jessica, I think the last episode we did was the Buffy the Vampire Slayer episode in terms of when this is going to be coming out. So, Jessica, tell everyone again how you discovered your love of horror.
Well, I've been a lifelong horror fan. I've always loved spooky things, Halloween, haunted houses, things like that. But in terms of horror movies, when I was 5 years old, I hid behind the couch when my parents rented Poltergeist. And I watched it and was just obsessed with all the scary parts. I've been obsessed with haunted house movies ever since. That's, you know, I love a lot of different subgenres, but that's where my heart lies. I'm just obsessed with, you know, creaking doors and whispers on the staircase, door slamming shut and spooky things happening in a house. So I'm just obsessed with haunted houses and kind of wanted to live in a haunted house. And ever since then, I've just been obsessed with watching as many horror movies as I can.
Talking about the female hysteria myth, and really that's going to be a theme throughout this panel discussion. So the medical profession is historically, and even in some instances today, inherently sexist. We all know this. Yes, everyone? Have you experienced this yourself when you go to the doctor?
Very much.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So we need only look to the history of hysteria to confirm this. And we've all experienced it ourselves. We often see women, AFAB, and especially like Black and non-Black women of color portrayed as hysteric, dramatic, and abrasive, even when they are simply trying to advocate for their own well-being. So history is not on their side in this matter, and hysteria is an example of this. As early as ancient Egypt, women's health was depicted as turbulent and troublesome. In ancient Greece, it was becoming increasingly common to write women off as mad or not having orgasmed enough. It was believed that women could be released from these conditions through sex, and that was many of the treatments recommended to women suffering from hysteria involved. So, like, one of the top recommended cures for hysteria was marriage.
So, that kind of seems like the antithesis of a solution. I'm being totally honest.
100%. Like, it's awfully convenient that, like, oh, you've got cancer. Oh, let this man have sex with you and you'll feel better. Like, it's very, very rigged to where it's giving men pleasure and letting men doing what they want with women and not really taking into account women's well-being or what they want. You know, as Blaine said, probably the opposite reaction would happen. But yeah, it's highly convenient that all these male doctors were just like, oh, well, let's do things that would benefit men to help you feel better, quote unquote.
Yeah, and it was even from like ancient times, and it just continued.
I mean, because it also benefits this idea of like the patriarchy, right? Because it puts women in a position where now you have to rely on this man that you have married for your sanity and for your physical well-being and your like stability, right? So it plays into all of these things. And I agree with you all, because now essentially this woman is trapped. And if she tries to leave the situation, she's crazy.
Yeah, not only that, but then she reaffirms this troublesome woman trope, essentially, that was created with this. And I think we probably see that referenced in some horror films as well, whether it's good representation or bad representation, depending on whose viewpoint those stories are told from. So hysteria was focused on the belief that the very presence of a uterus must cause these symptoms. The term hysteria was even coined in ancient Greece from the word hystera, which meant womb, or still means womb. These damaging beliefs about women remained present throughout history and have greatly impacted how medicine is used to treat and diagnose individuals with uteruses.
How many of us have gone to the doctor or a medical provider and told them that we were experiencing an issue? And the first question was, well, are you on your period? Is it worse when you're on your period?
Yeah. Could you be pregnant?
It's all questions about your uterus. And it's like, dude, my guy, I'm talking about depression. What? Everything's worse on my period. Let's move on.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of that. There is this great piece by Terry Capsalis called Hysteria, Witches, and the Wandering Uterus, A Brief History, where Capsalis writes, the uterus was believed to wander around the body like an animal hungry for semen. This is reality. This is the reality back in the time period when the diagnosis of hysteria existed. If it wandered the wrong direction and made its way to the throat, there would be choking, coughing, or loss of voice. If it got stuck in the rib cage, there would be chest pain or shortness of breath, and so on. Most any symptom that belonged to a female body could be attributed to the wandering uterus. So treatments included things like vaginal fumigations, bitter potions, balms, and pessaries. A pessary is a soft, flexible device that is placed in the vagina to help support the bladder, vagina, uterus, and or rectum. So that's what was being used back in the day. Pessaries made of wool. I think, is this like an early tampon? Is that what that is? Can anyone help me out? Who's got Google?
I truly hope it is not.
I don't.
But
I have
no
idea.
That's what it sounds like.
It sounds like that. I mean, I have to look it up. But
no, that's exactly what it is. It's basically a wool tampon. Okay.
It is, in fact, not that. We were all wrong. I looked it up, and pessaries are for the use of pelvic organ prolapse. So in the Middle Ages, linen and cotton wool soaked in many different potions were used for this as some sort of like temporary cure. And as new materials were discovered, pessaries evolved and began to resemble those used today. So cork and brass were replaced at some point with rubber. Modern day pessaries, because apparently they're still used, are made of non-reactive silicone and come in various designs and sizes to suit each individual. Those were all used to bring the uterus back into its proper place, right? So also there was genital massage performed by a skilled physician or midwife, and that was often mentioned in medical writings.
I mean, I think it's just really interesting because, you know, like a low class way of saying this is just that, like, women are just these like kind of like come hungry monsters. And if we don't get that, chaos ensues. And I feel like that's kind of like we see that in so many stories now where I'm sure the films we're going to get into it. But you know, we see the women who are upsetting these communities or these ways of life, and they're typically seen as like, quote unquote, loose women. And like, they're here to kind of upend everyone's morals. And it's sad to me to see just how far back that goes.
Well, and I think that's, there's the trope of like, and I'm calling them tropes because I think that they are rooted in horror cinema that way. But there's the trope of like the loose woman, as you talked about. She must have something kind of like demonic within her, or there's the witchcraft aspect of it, or there's even like the divorced woman or something like that. Like, this is a woman who was assertive enough to ask for a divorce versus being divorced. But even either way that it played out, you would always be sort of shunned from society as a woman earlier on, before divorce like became super popular. So the triad of marriage, intercourse, and pregnancy was the ultimate treatment for, as you said, the semen hungry womb. The uterus was a troublemaker and was best sated when pregnant. And that is like some of the history there. But medical attention veered from the hungry uterus and was placed on a woman's so-called weaker nervous system. 19th century physician Russell Thacker Trail approximated that 3/4 of all medical practice was devoted to the diseases of women. It was believed that hysteria could be set off by a plethora of bad habits, including reading novels, which caused erotic fantasies, masturbation, and homosexual or bisexual tendencies, resulting in any number of symptoms such as seductive behaviors, contractures, functional paralysis, irrationality, and general troublemaking of various kinds. There are pages and pages of medical writings outing hysterics as great liars who willingly deceive. So this was really interesting for me, especially like the erotic fantasies part, because if I point to something modern day, like housewives going nuts and masturbating to like 50 Shades of Grey, is that an example of hysteria? I don't know.
I'm not a housewife who's masturbated to 50 Shades of Grey, but what your point got me thinking about is, you know, our medical system, even today, everything just points back to us kind of, you know, it's perceived that we're making mountains out of molehills with everything. If it's something physical, like we touched on earlier, everything kind of comes back to our uterus, or, you know, are we maybe just kind of blowing things out of proportion? Even trying to get diagnosed with something legitimate, like ADHD as an adult woman, is really difficult because, you know, they say we're supposed to get that done as kids. And, you know, women don't really get that, but we do. So I think it's just sad. Again, sad all around that we're still seeing this.
I couldn't agree with you more. And as someone who, I was diagnosed at the age of 19 with polycystic ovarian syndrome. So what that means is like I can grow these gigantic softball plus size like cysts on my ovaries. It could topple them over. I've had multiple surgeries for this, and it like just your uterus is a battlefield, and so are your ovaries, and it affects your whole body. It creates hormonal imbalance, insulin resistance, all kinds of things. And so from the time I was 19, most of the time that I go to the doctor, everything is then blamed on this pre-existing condition.
I was just going to say, yeah, I'm a fellow PCOS person here. So
hello,
is something.
This is now a support group.
Yeah. But yeah, and it's so common just to blame it on that because it's convenient. And also, not all people with PCOS have this, but a lot of people with PCOS are overweight. And something that is very common in the medical field is to blame someone's weight, especially if it's a woman, especially if it's a woman of color. Like, they just want to blame everything on, oh, well, you're fat, so that's the issue. There couldn't be something else going on that we need to address and help you solve. We're going to blame it on this. It's everything is very convenient about finding a way to blame a woman for existing, or existing in a way that's not palatable to society. And that's like the whole history of women's medicine is based on blaming women instead of trying to help them.
Yeah. And we could talk all day about fat phobia in the medical community. So I'm right there with you on that.
Yeah. Just to add to that, because like I have a friend who is a Black woman who is overweight and who has PCOS and has had it obviously since like she started her period, but wasn't diagnosed until college because she was Black first. So of course you can't be in pain because you're a Black woman. Then she was overweight. So then it must be because you're overweight and Black, right? So like your environment is causing all of these problems. And when she finally got diagnosed, one, she was so relieved, but two, she was so angry because if she would have gotten the correct medical treatment in the first place, years of pain and trauma would have been avoided.
Kind of tracking back to this, it is no accident such a diagnosis took off just as some of these same women were fighting to gain access to universities and various professions in the US and Europe. A decrease in marriages and falling birth rates coincided with the medical diagnosis of hysteria, criticizing the new woman and her focus on intellectual, artistic, or activist pursuits instead of motherhood, which is interesting. And I think we see that in a lot of scores of women artists and writers were diagnosed as hysterics in a period when rebelliousness, shamelessness, ambition, and overeducation were considered to be likely causes. Too much energy going up to the brain instead of staying in the reproductive organs and helping the female body do what it was supposed to do. So transgressing prescribed roles would make women sick. British suffragettes, for instance, were treated as hysterics in prison. Outspoken proponents for women's rights were often characterized as the shrieking sisterhood.
I just love that even biologically, our bodies are supposed to be telling us to get back in the kitchen. Like, what? Ma'am? No.
Yeah, it's just when you read this stuff and the fact that it's actually real and it occurred, it just seems crazy. Which in which is funny because we're supposed to be crazy, the crazy ones.
But I feel like this was also like a conspiracy to not to prevent women from being doctors so that they couldn't say, this is crazy. This doesn't make any sense.
Yes, it's like a bunch of men got in a room and were like, you know how we can shut them up? Just be like, you're crazy. It's a medical condition.
Well, and to Lauren's point, how often do we see that among so many populations, like, you know, right now, the trans community, as they become more empowered and more visible, we're seeing more and more action to take their rights away. And, you know, that's just one small example. But yeah, I mean, throughout history, even throughout our lives, right, as soon as we start to think for ourselves and start to gain our own power and self-confidence, something or someone is quick to remind us or quick to humble us and put us in our place.
Yeah, it's like when people tell you to respect your elders when you're having a totally reasonable conversation and making very valid points.
Yes, like anything to, you know, you're too young, you're too queer, you're too female, anything to put you in your place. And I totally agree that it is a conspiracy to make sure the women can't say, actually, this is what's going on and this is how we can treat it, and anything to keep women from having power, you know, anything to keep women in their place, as Blaine said, in the kitchen, you know, make sure that women and all the different, like, especially marginalized women, make sure that they can't advocate for themselves and can't take their own power into their own hands to solve their own problems, because God knows they could solve them better.
And all of this to the point also that you'll just die, right? Like, nothing is going to, like, we are not going to let up on these ideas that this is just hysterical and y'all need to calm down, even to the point where you will die because of the things that we refuse to address.
I mean, I think it's all just a fear of uprising, you know, from gender, class, race, like every aspect that's not a traditionally, you know, white, cis, male perspective.
Yeah. And to me, that's one of the most terrifying things when I think about the realities of this. And the fact that there are a lot of people out there, and some women included, especially when it comes to the community of trans women that people are trying to oppress, especially that's prevalent in the news right now. Like, there's always going to be people that are trying to oppress women, people of color, and it's because they're holding on to these ideals from I don't know how long ago.
And I think that that stems from, like, a sense of having power and protection, right? Because in all of my research of Black and women of color in relation to their white counterparts, right? And this idea that, you know, to protect yourself, you have to hold on to this idea of this patriarchal version of life and this patriarchal way of living. Because the closer you are to that, the safer you are. And I feel like in the conversations that we're having, and I think it's displayed in a lot of the films that we've chosen, that the people who hold on to those core values and ostracize and other the people who are trying to advocate for themselves are doing so as a really terrible form of self-preservation.
I mean, I think it's really nice that we all agree with all of this stuff too. I feel like I'm just piggybacking on everyone else's great perspective, but I think something that's interesting is that, like, we keep, as like a culture, we talk about these old values and these old morals, but like, they're just current values. It's just how people think. You know, being a feminist or standing up for queer rights or, you know, Black Lives Matter, that's not new. You know, like, people have believed in these movements and these morals and values for centuries. It's just for some reason, when we talk about, like, the good old days and the good old boys, it always goes back to, like, the shittier way of life. For some reason, that's always upheld as the tradition instead of the other things that have been here for so long. You know, queer people aren't new. Like, yeah, we've been here forever, you know?
None of it's new. I think it has a lot more to do with who's in power, who has a seat at the table, who has had the voice. Or a voice that people actually get to hear.
I just wanted to go back to what Lauren said about that self-preservation that we see in a lot of folks who want to succeed in a patriarchal society. And so they go along to get along. And, you know, that's where we see, you know, people like Ann Coulter or a lot of white feminists, quote unquote. And it is what keeps us, I mean, aside from the cis white men, right? That's what keeps us stuck in this grind of, please just fucking listen to us. It's so frustrating.
Well, this is where things start to get even more interesting. So in the Middle Ages, by way of the church, the myth flourished that women were evil, that this idea of hysteria. So lust and carnal pleasures were the problem with women who were by nature lascivious and deceptive. Female sexuality, once again, was the problem. So-called witches were accused of making men impotent. Their penises would disappear, and it was claimed that witches would keep said penises in a nest in a tree. Unholy spirits were the cause of bewitchment, a condition that sounded a lot like earlier descriptions of hysteria, and its treatment led to the death of thousands of women. In their 1973 groundbreaking treatise, Witches, Midwives, and Nurses, Barbara Ehrenreich, I have to look it up, and Deidre English argued that the first accusations of witchcraft in Europe grew out of church-affiliated male doctors' anxieties about competition from female healers. The violence promoted by the church allowed for the rise of the European medical profession when hysteria and that medical diagnosis became really, really prevalent.
Not that we needed any proof, obviously, but the fact that at first the problem was that women weren't having enough sex, and then the problem was that women were having too much sex, proves that women are not actually the problem. Like,
it's because we were having loose sex out of our marriage beds.
Yeah, it's rigged so that you cannot win. You can't. You're having too much sex. You're not having enough sex. You're not having the right kind of sex. It's all about control. And I the hypocrisy of it just blows my mind. It shouldn't surprise
what is it?
Me, but
wanton, it, yeah. Wanton women.
Yes.
Okay, so first, I would like to say that I do keep penises in a nest in my backyard, in a tree. And also, yes, wait, darn it, Jessica, what did you just say that I agreed with and I loved it?
That women can't win. What, you were having too much sex, not enough, the wrong kind. It's all about control.
That's right. The hypocrisy of it all, and just the fact that we are left to figure it out on our own. And we only know if we're on the right path when we are completely invisible. And we know when we're doing it wrong when a man tells us.
Just for the record, that's why everyone should have known that this was a bunch of hullabaloo, because no one is keeping a penis as a trophy, let alone hanging it like an ornament on a tree.
Except for Blaine. We've established that so far.
Except for Blaine.
So.
Sorry.
Briefly circling back to women and hysteria in the history of mental health, hysteria as a mental disorder was one of the first ever attributed to women. Freud considered it to be an exclusively female disease. So over 4,000 years of history, this disease was considered from two perspectives, both scientific and demonological. And it's super interesting because the fact that it was cured with herbs, sex, sexual abstinence, or punished and purified with fire for its association with sorcery, and finally clinically studied as a disease and treated with innovative therapies is mind-boggling. It had only these two dominant scientific approaches for this as a mental disorder. So the magic, demonological, and the scientific views in relation to women, not only is a woman vulnerable to mental disorders, she is weak and easily influenced by supernatural or organic degeneration, and she is somehow guilty of sinning or not procreating. And for this, thus she has this mental disorder. And it's so often misunderstood and misinterpreted and generates scientific or like moral bias defined as pseudoscientific prejudice. And that's really what we're seeing with this idea of female hysteria and this myth that has been around for over like 4,000 years. So let's talk a little bit about consent as viewers as well within consuming horror media, because I had a really interesting experience recently at a lecture where I was shown certain types of images that I did not consent to. And it did make me uncomfortable. And maybe the intent was to be jarring, but I feel like I should have had the choice going into it.
Yeah. I mean, even like having done festivals, I'm usually my film is with a bunch of other men. And I was just thinking as you were talking, they don't put up like content warnings at film festivals that like so many films are going to have depictions of attempted assault or assaults in them. And I was wondering, like, how would it change festivals if they had to put all of those films or shorts into one block and label it that way? Because so many blocks are labeled as like, oh, a good laugh, or, you know, slasher fun. Like, what if this one is just deeply upsetting for no reason other than a man feels that this is a way to convey something scary?
Well, and that's interesting because, like, once films go through the process of being, like, rated, right, they get those descriptors. But, like, when you start something up, it's, like, make, like, on television, it may contain depictions of violence, sexual assault, et cetera, et cetera. I'm like, thank you, SVU, for doing that for me, or else I wouldn't watch this show, which I don't watch it often because it's a bit triggering. But, yeah, like, why is that not common with these things? Because, like, there's a lot of films I want to see. I'm like, oh, this looks really interesting. But then you get into it, you're like, oh, wow, that was really, really disturbing. And it's like, yes, in a way, you should. They're trying to garner this certain type of reaction from you. But intent is important. But, like, at the same time, I think you need to prepare your audience for what they're going to receive.
Just really quickly, because the men would riot. I was on a film festival panel where I had to select the films. And somebody put in this whole thing that was just entirely too much trauma for no reason. So I was like, if you're going to put this in the festival, there has to be a content warning on the front. They emailed the filmmaker and he called. And you would have thought that we would have told him, I don't know, it had to be purple or something. Like, I don't know. He was so mad. And I'm just like, you know what?
I just want to say thank you for doing that. It sounds like something more people would want to be part of, knowing that someone on a panel is making sure that the audience isn't subjected to, you know, horror isn't just triggering things, right? You know, like, it doesn't, I mean, sure, stabbing is scary and triggering, but horror doesn't have to be triggering to very specific audience members.
And I think you can find ways to depict things that allow people like myself, horror has been a great coping mechanism for trauma, but you can present things that someone can identify with your work in that way without having to actually have the act on screen, especially really graphically. And it's not that you can't have something similar, but you don't need, I mean, I just heard about a film where that was like an hour of someone being sexually assaulted. And I was just like, wow, that got made.
I have had my jaw on my desk this entire time. Like, I can't believe that happened to Lauren. I'm just terrified. And so what I want to point out is, do you think maybe that we're seeing more and more depictions of sexual assault or sexual violence because there's this push for more shocking media, that we're trying to push the envelope, or, you know, cis white men are trying to push the envelope and think that showing the harm of women is the way to do that?
So I've done comedy since 2011, and it's wearing on me, you guys.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
No, not in like a bad way. It's just that, like, ever since I was that young, like, I've just been subjected to what people think is edgy comedy. And of course, like, I think everyone can look back and think, like, oh, that's not something I'm interested or I find funny anymore. But I think it's just like comedy and horror are kind of the same. You know, there's like a setup and then a payoff. And someone once said about the comedy community, anyone can like walk up and try comedy. You can go and do a sketch show or improv or stand up, And the same can be said for horror. You know, the one of the film festivals I was part of, I was the only female director. I was the only person with a female primary cast. And of the, I don't know, say like maybe 10 shorts that played, probably about half of them depicted sexual assault or attempted sexual assault. And I think instead of them like trying to push the envelope, I think like it's just people have been trying to push, men have been trying to push the same envelope the same way for decades. And I think maybe they could create a different gore effect or add a joke somewhere instead of just making women the punching bag for everything. And like there are revenge stories and redemptions that don't have to tie back to a traumatic assault.
I'm just going to throw out a film that came out in 2020. I think it's fantastic. There is a film called Alone. There were three films in 2020 with this name. Two are zombie movies. This film is a film that follows someone who is like moving from the Pacific Northwest to a new place after the loss of their husband. And this woman, she is pursued by a man and taken captive, but a sex act never occurs. An assault of that nature never occurs. And it is a revenge horror film that doesn't depict the sexual assault portion at all. It doesn't actually happen. It never gets that far. The intent is there and you know it. And that's really all that was needed. And for that, it's a film I rave about and highly recommend if you are someone who enjoys revenge horror films.
I think I'm a huge fan of Alone. I love that movie for a lot of different reasons, but it had not occurred to me until just now that it's a rape revenge movie without the rape, which is very important in not, you don't have to depict it to know, like you say, like there's a line from the movie that has always stuck in my head because it's so disturbing. He's screaming at her in the woods for her to come back and he calls her, "You delicious bitch." And like that is as close as it gets to depicting anything like a sexual assault. And that's as close as it has to get because you know what's going on just from that.
I just dry heaved. What?
You know what he wants and you know he's probably going to murder her after. So and it's like it was enough, though. It was enough. We didn't need the depiction of the assault on screen. And I for that and the way that it was done, I thought was really great. And I think a lot of people knocked the film for not having all the violence in it from that perspective, the assault perspective. But I don't think it needed it.
Yeah. And if me saying that line was triggering or disturbing, I sincerely apologize. I should have thought better of that.
I agree with Shannon. I feel like every man who's making a horror film is trying to remake Last House on the Left. And I needed to stop because I haven't heard of Alone. So I appreciate y'all for bringing this film into my life because I was like, oh, look at that. A miracle.
Yes. Alone is streaming on Hulu. So hopefully you get a chance to enjoy it. In my research for this panel, another author wrote that the concept of linking femininity with evil merged during the Middle Ages, similar to what the other author was talking about. Possession in particular was added to the list of symptoms in hysteria. So it was believed that demonic forces were attracted to melancholic and lower beings like women, especially if they were single or elderly, since not being sexually active and not serving your man was against everything. Due to this reason, many documents of that time period describe women not as patients, but the cause of a human disease. Isn't that fascinating? We need more horror films about this. Like, really, I was looking for horror films. A few films that came to mind are Burn, Witch, Burn, where a housewife is depicted as becoming hysterical and, like, turning to witchcraft to solve that anxiety surrounding her husband and things like that. And then there's actually other, like, actual practicing witches out there who are using the forces of darkness against her and her husband. And then, of course, there's Rosemary's Baby, which is like a fantastic depiction of this idea of like a hysterical woman in the 1960s. And I don't know, I just, it's that's probably one of the best allegories for the female hysteria myth and then this supernatural demonological element. Thinkers of that time traced the perception of demonic women to disorderly behavior and further validated masculine control. The reason given for this behavior was corrupted sexuality or like maternity. Parallels can be drawn to current issues as well, like freedom of sexual choices and orientation, reproductive rights, and not pursuing motherhood. So women advocating these issues are still considered rebellious and antithetical to the established order of society. So, question for everyone, how do you believe the medical myths associated with the notion of female hysteria have influenced horror cinema?
So, I mean, just for a very specific example, the moment I read that prompt, The Conjuring from 2013 came to mind because, you know, of course you've got this possession and of course, you know, through history, we've learned that, oh, if you're possessed, you're weaker and you're more vulnerable, and that's why the demon chose you. So, of course, in The Conjuring, who else but the housewife becomes possessed ultimately and tries to kill her children and falls into just becoming insane? And that's what automatically came to mind. And I think that, I mean, also The Exorcist, but yeah, those are good examples.
The first things that came to my mind were repulsion, where the quote-unquote frigid woman is insane. That kind of ties into, to me, hagsploitation, where, you know, you've got ageism, where older women are viewed as inherently sexless, and as a result, these older women are quote-unquote crazy. This idea that if women aren't having sex with men and having, you know, pleasing men often enough that they're insane. Like, you see it in a lot of movies and even in a whole subgenre, I think. So it definitely permeates horror.
The movie that's popped into my head just because I've seen it recently is The Conjuring Hour. And in relation to the role of a woman and what we as women shouldn't do to, like, not be possessed, I always go back to this idea of like the man in your life and how you're supposed to be serving him, and how in a lot of these narratives that we see, it's always this like love will conquer all thing. Like the men who try to come to be the savior push this story of like, if I love her hard enough, the demon will leave her body and she'll be back to the woman that I need in my life and that I loved.
And to that point, I mean, when you've got a possession, who do they call on to save this weak little woman? The power
old
of
white
Christ.
Men.
Old yes. White men. So God, please help this hysterical woman. Ugh.
And bring her back exactly the way in which she left, right? We're going to not address any of the trauma.
Bring her back as the obedient housewife that I need her to be. So many feminists started associating hysteria and its demonic past with empowerment. Their claim was that those women were one of the first to oppose the meek behavior of a traditional female and explore alternatives. And many started reclaiming their stands of witches in order to showcase strength, power, and fearlessness. And I think we sort of get that a lot with the way that people are drawn towards witchcraft in modern times, specifically women. I mean, myself included, and a sense of empowerment that sort of comes from claiming that no matter how you practice. But today, hysteria is still used to denote a woman's loud behavior, followed by the statement, stop PMSing.
I think too that, like, one that I've had that said to me before and I punched somebody in the face. So like, it's not a good thing to say to anybody ever. But I also remember this time when I think I was in high school and I was going to the bathroom. And you know how you do that thing in high school where like you hide your tampon in your backpack and you take your whole backpack to the bathroom? I was like, I can't keep doing this. So I just grabbed a handful of tampons and left. And all the guys made such a big deal about it. But because I wasn't embarrassed or ashamed, then something was automatically wrong with me. And it's insane that that is the narrative that still persists.
there's a lot of shame associated with when you first enter puberty and you start your period as a woman. And we're often taught to like sort of hide it and keep it a secret. Like we can say, oh yeah, my cramps are bad, and talk about it maybe with our girlfriends, but even among each other, it's like, ew, ew, we don't want to hear about it. So I think maybe that's not the case now. I was a child of the 90s, but Shannon, go for it.
Yeah, just to your point, I definitely lived that shame as well, hiding pads and tampons. And even like, I've always had big boobs. I grew boobs pretty early. And like, it's so sad. There are pictures of me like with my family trying to minimize my body as much as possible. But I'm just like fully hunched over and like folding in on myself. And like, there's just, I don't know if there's a better visual representation of just full on shame than those pictures of me. But something I've been thinking about too, the hysteria thing, you know, there's big hysteria, but there's also like everyday hysteria, which I'm sure everyone here has experienced too, like at work or even in just general life, people saying that maybe you're aggressive instead of being assertive or confident, you know, being too emotional about this, or maybe not being, you're just not ready for this step. You know, I think someone else is a little better suited, and it's literally like the same qualifications, other than outward expression of gender. So I think the hysteria is kind of a spectrum too, in how we're still kind of affected by it.
Going back to the stop PMSing, that goes right back into the women are damned if they do, damned if they don't. Because if you express an opinion or you express an emotion and someone tells you to stop PMSing and you get angry, justifiably angry at that, they will use that as proof that you are PMSing. Like there's no way to escape this accusation of being the crazy one, the irrational one, just by virtue of you being someone who menstruates, being someone, you know, who has this physical attribute. It's another way to say, oh, well, clearly you're the crazy one. And it's so insidious because there's no way to fight against it. If you get angry at someone for calling you crazy, they use that as proof that you're PMSing instead of, no, this person is upset justifiably at you accusing them of something so sexist and misogynist.
Well, I'm going to transition into something where we're jumping ahead in the centuries here. And Taylor Pruitt writes about other influences of the hysteria myth. In their editorial, Take Some Pills for Your Hysteria, Lady, America's Long History of Drugging Up Women. So this is where we get into Mother's Little Helpers. So women are twice as likely as men to be prescribed prescription drugs for depression or anxiety. While it's true that women experience depression and anxiety at higher rates than men, at least reportedly by scientific study, this still doesn't explain the intense level of prescription disparity. Even with disorders that skew heavily male, like ADHD, women are more likely to be prescribed medication. And, you know, I think some of this goes into fragile masculinity. And like coming forward with the symptoms that you're experiencing. I think women are more likely to say, hey, I'm having an issue. Can I get some help with this?
Women are definitely more likely to talk about their concerns and their issues because, you know, how often have we been in situations where there's something very wrong or concerning going on, but the men in the room are saying nothing and hoping that they can just ignore it and it'll go away. I think,
right. If you don't talk about it, it isn't real.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
And that is super prevalent still in lots of different issues, not only in America, but across the world, right? And then when we do talk about it, people get very angry.
Yes, that's exactly what I was going to say. Thank you. So yes, women are more likely to come forward and talk about their symptoms. And we just continue to, well, it is continued that we're shaming men. The society is telling men that, yes, they need to come forward, but don't come forward like that. They are starting to experience the hypocrisy and double standards, at least where mental health is concerned, that we have experienced, women and femmes have experienced throughout history.
So Dr. Edward Shorter, a psychiatrist and author of How Everyone Became Depressed, stated to Vice magazine that direct-to-consumer advertising has an abundance of dramatic images of women who were locked in the depths of despair. On the next page, you see them beaming with delight, hand wrestling in the bar after they take their antidepressant. And like, I think I see this even now when I see drug advertisements and commercials. Anyone else?
Oh, yeah. You've all seen those commercials where there's like a woman and it's gray and she's sad. And then she pops this pill and now the sun is shining and she can ride a bike. And I'm just like, what? But then it's funny because going back to like, you know, we ignore this up until the point of death. While she's smiling and riding a bike and playing wiffle ball, it says, oh, and by the way, this drug could cause like heart palpitations and shortness of breath and suicidal tendencies.
And I'm death.
Like, right.
Yeah. No. And it's like, and death. In some rare cases, and death. It's like, oh, okay, please. I would love that pill.
I mean, even bringing it back to like menstruation, we see the same exact advertising for birth control, which has a ton of really scary side effects and possible complications. And even in advertising, I mean, think about like the tampon, like any kind of like period product commercial. It's always, it used to be kind of like the soft, like I'm in the bathroom, I'm serene. And now it's like, you can rock out with these tampons, baby, get our tampons. And It's just very funny to me that even now they're like, all right, it's 2022. We're feminists. Women can rock climb. People with uteruses can, I don't know, kick in the air. But like, it's still just, I don't know, it's just empty advertising. Like, as long as there's menstruation, we're going to need a way to kind of manage it or clean it up or do something with it. And it just seems like there's never been someone with a uterus behind a single piece of content, not a photographer, not a writer, nothing. It's just like men being like, I don't know, what do ladies like to do? Rock climb, I guess. And they can't do that if they don't have our tampons.
Honestly, I think watching something like Mad Men was really illuminating for me at the time that it came out. Because I think I was still, when did Mad Men first air? Does anybody know? I feel like I was maybe in college. Yeah. Okay. I was like just wrapping up college and, but it was illuminating to see people from like my grandmother's generation. And it's like, yeah, you're just the housewife at home, like drinking your Canadian Mist, which is definitely what my grandmother was hiding under her bed when I was a child. So I assume she was doing it in the 1950s.
Well, and to go back to that, I mean, Shannon also talked about birth control and how harmful it is. And then the moment we started talking about or started testing birth control on men, and they experienced the exact same symptoms that people with uteruses experience, they shut it down completely. They're like, absolutely not. We will not be uncomfortable.
Do you know the first time I saw a tampon commercial, I went and I found my friends and I was like, can we not ride bikes when we're on our periods? What's happening? I don't want that to happen to me. Like, I was so shocked by the advertisement because it really made it seem like women would be invalid for a week. And then to the point about like birth control and even like side effects of being on your period, when I first got my period and I had really terrible cramps, I went to the doctor and the doctor's like, no, you'll be fine. This is just what happens. And I feel like it's the same thing with birth control. It's like, oh no, this is just what happens to you. It's great. It's fine. But it's only what happens to you if you are a woman.
Yeah. So can I tell an embarrassing story? So I will tell you the story that I wasn't even aware of tampons until my 20s, because my mother immediately like was just like, here's a pad. And I thought that's the only thing that existed.
I didn't know you weren't supposed to flush them until my 20s. I fucked up a lot of plumbing in a lot of places, I think.
You're the reason they put those signs on bathroom doors.
Yeah, and I'm like, what? That surely they're talking about something else. Even like my old workplace, the sign they put up, it was like, the porcelain goddess does not accept offerings of certain products. And
why can't you just say it in normal English?
Yeah, I was like, now I'm definitely putting a tampon in there. I'm going to do that right now. What are you talking
like
about?
I need to feed the ghoulies. Like, come on.
Yeah, sounds like she's hungry.
Wow. I'm just thinking about the toilet from Look Who's Talking 2. Yeah. That's the one. If you know, you know. So females have long been targeted by pharmaceutical advertising, as we've mentioned, and massive disparities in prescription drug use have been around almost as long as prescription drugs have been around. So one of the earliest painkillers, morphine, was a notoriously feminine vice. Morphine and drugs like laudanum treated the distinctly female conditions of pregnancy, childbirth, and menstrual pain. So they also had the added benefit of not being alcohol, a drug that 19th century American women crusaded against in a transgression that could besmirch one's reputation. By the end of the 1800s, more than two-thirds of the country's opium and morphine addicts were women. Because this is what was being prescribed for our hysterics. So by 1903, a new addictive class of pharmacological agents called barbiturates were on the rise, used as sedatives meant to treat nervousness and anxiety. The drug's common use as a sleeping pill fit nicely with the common rest cure prescribed to women, including Virginia Woolf and Charlotte Perkins Gilman, who were both diagnosed with hysteria. By era physicians. Like their opiate-laced predecessors, the pills were highly addictive. As men returned home from World War II and women re-entered the domestic realm, mother's little helpers like Valium and Librium enabled housewives to cope with the mundane tasks of their everyday lives. By the time the earliest studies on the drug class were conducted in the 1960s, women were being prescribed Valium twice as much as men. As the Milltown class of drugs became known as solely women's drugs in the 1950s and 1960s, the kind of far-reaching neuroses the drugs treated were considered feminine as well. Medical journals from the time period depict viciously misogynist cartoons of stereotypical anxious female patients with vague complaints and anxieties. Though modern women don't have to contend with the same kind of ignorance, there is still a common perception that the female sex is sadder or at least more emotional than the opposite sex.
I think we've all heard that Rolling Stones song, Mother's Little Helper, and that came out in the 60s. So it kind of just shows how prevalent this thought was that, oh, well, bored little housewives, just give her some barbiturates and, you know, knock her right out. She'll be great.
This persists in horror and like thriller moments too, because I watched that show One of Us is Lying, and there's a moment where this girl is more aware, I think, or cares more than all of the other characters, and the first thing someone says is just take a pill and chill out, and that's only ever directed at women.
I was going to say, on the mother's little helper tip, I had a boss who did not know that I was on antidepressants at the time, but was talking for some reason about antidepressants very derisively and just referred to all medicine that's used to help people with mental illness as pills for bored housewives. So, and this was maybe 10 or 15 years ago, 10 years ago. So I feel like the idea that, not that I think that y'all think this, but the idea that that was an idea for the Mad Men era that we have escaped from is not true, because that is still very much a common philosophy among certain people that, you know, bored housewives who just want something to help them make the day go by are the ones who need help with things.
Just to piggyback off of what Jessica said, I mean, at what point this problem still persists today, and I apologize for stuttering constantly, but when I went to my parents when I was 13 years old and I was like, hey, I would love to talk to a therapist, it was immediately, oh, well, you're just a little girl who needs attention. What do you need? Like, what are you trying to get out of this? It's not really a concern about any femme's mental health. It is when you seek mental health help or when you seek help in general, femmes are often told they're seeking attention or they're bored or they just aren't happy with their life.
I just wanted to point out too, in talking about like expectations of how women handle things or how women are supposed to handle things and the medical stopgaps in which they are supported, right? That's also dependent upon your race and your class. Because I feel like if you are Black and poor, you're deemed hysterical because you're not being strong enough, or you're saying that the weight that you're supposed to be able to bear with ease is too heavy, or something along those lines. And if you are white and rich in this case, then you get like the mommy's little helper pill and you have all these other expectations that you're not living up to, which deems you hysteric.
I think a metric or statistic I would like to look at is during that era of mommy's little helper, like how many women were prescribed this medication and how many women, specifically women of color, were committed to psychiatric institutions instead of given these pills. Because I can see there being a huge disparity.
Right.
Or just not getting any help at all.
And I want to know how many like women of color were arrested maybe, or like placed in jail for their medical, for like a medical emergency, or like, what is it called?
A crisis?
Thank you. Yes. I wonder, because like all of this is stemmed from having a crisis happen.
Yes.
Which is why you need to go and do these things, right? So how many were prescribed these pills? How many were institutionalized? And how many were jailed based upon their race and class?
Well, and then I think at the same time, we have people that were jailed and then sent to psychiatric institutions as a means of... I guess it was said that they were like hysteric in jail, or they were having a crisis. But like a lot of times, people were then institutionalized from the jail system.
Well, and you'll see that people are just kind of trucked right into the mental facility, or they are trapped in jail and not given any resources for their mental health, and that just furthers the problem. I mean, jail in general is a problem, but to see that there are still so many people wrongly imprisoned simply because they needed mental health help and they weren't getting it because, you know, to Lauren's point, they were poor, they were Black, they were X, Y, and Z, but they weren't a rich white cis person.
We're going to pivot over and get into exploring hysterics and witchcraft in folk horror and other horror cinema. We're going to get into the film selections that everybody chose to talk about.
Okay, my first film is V from 1967. It's a Russian horror movie, the first Soviet horror movie. One of the reason I love V so much is the effects are amazing. Like, they hold up today as being like really astonishing, really inventive, and they show the power of magic. But so a young witch exposes the hypocrisy of a young seminary student named Coma. He arrives at her home. They're on break, begging for things he doesn't need. He's claiming he's starving and calling her a skinflint when she doesn't feed him. When all the seminary students leave the seminary for their break, they immediately start stealing from people. They start assaulting women. So clearly not the godliest of men. The old woman, she's a young witch, but she appears to Coma as an old woman, and she tries to seduce him. He refuses her sexual advances, and she puts a spell on him and rides him like a horse, and they start flying through the air. And when they land, he beats her to death, but when she is dying, she reassumes her form as a beautiful young woman, and that's the only time that he feels remorse, when he sees, oh, it's a beautiful young lady that I've killed instead of this old woman who I'm not attracted to. And when she dies, her last wish is for Coma to read her her last rites, to do a blessing for her for 3 nights to make sure her soul goes to heaven. So her father calls Coma over to their house, and he has to spend the night with the body 3 nights in a row. And every night she tests his faith. And, you know, as established previously in the movie, this is not someone who lives by the word of God as it's presented in the movie. You know, they're thieves, they're, you know, rapists, they're not good people. And so she tests his faith every night. And obviously, you know, his faith is not the strongest. He doesn't really believe in God. He just wants to be in seminary for the power, because you have a lot of privilege when you're in the seminary compared to the people who aren't in that system. So she, you know, you can view the movie as fitting in with what we've talked about already, with, oh, you know, women are seducers, women, their lust for sex is what gets everybody into trouble, because she seduces him early on, or tries to seduce him early on. And when she fails, that's when she punishes him. But I see it as her punishing his hypocrisy. You know, she exposes his lack of faith and defeats him that way, because if he had remained faithful to God and been, you know, holy, quote unquote, according to the rules of his church, he would have survived those 3 nights. It's not a matter of seduction or a wandering womb or being semen hungry. It's a matter of her using witchcraft to expose the church's hypocrisy and undermine the male power of the seminary. So that's why I thought it was a really good representation of what we've been talking about. And my second choice is Hellbender from 2021. This is obviously a new movie. It's on Shudder right now, and I highly recommend everybody check it out. Izzy and her mother are both hellbenders. They're powerful witches / demons who gain their power from the fear in human blood. Izzy's mother tries to live. Izzy discovers her power accidentally and starts to grow in it, and she gets a taste for it. Hellbenders procreate when the daughter of a hellbender kills her mother. Then the daughter gives birth to her own hellbender, and the natural cycle continues. And to me, that completely upends this male desire for control over women's bodies, over how, when, and with whom women procreate, by having total agency over when and how they get pregnant. And by removing men from the equation entirely, hellbenders represent the thing that men have historically feared most, which is not having power. Additionally, Izzy and her mom are both folk healers. They use natural things in the woods. They eat thistles and berries. They use ivy and spider webs and huckleberries to gain extra power. They only use that knowledge on themselves. But again, this idea that they are more knowledgeable and more powerful than the men who are supposed to be the healers, to me, is another positive representation. This is a really strong female story. It's not even disrupting male power. It's taking male power out of the equation entirely.
I just really love Hellbender, and I'm so glad you brought that to the table, Jessica. I don't think that there's another person who could do it better.
Thank you so much. And yes, Hellbender is the best. Everybody should go watch it.
I also love Hellbender. So everyone, if you haven't seen Hellbender, it's fantastic. And I had an opportunity to speak with the filmmakers and talk more about it. So if you haven't listened to it yet, you can listen to our interview with the Addams family of filmmakers on the Slayaway podcast.
All right. So first up, we have Season of the Witch from 1973 by none other than George Romero. It depicts a wife to a perpetually absent husband and mother to an adult daughter. The main character's name is Joan, and she feels stifled, unsatisfied, and sensitive about her age. With images of subjugation and assault haunting her dreams, she searches for new methods of empowerment and begins to experiment with witchcraft. So what this film does, it really takes us inside the hysteria and gives us a first-person account of being a housewife and trying so hard to fit into this mold that was created for us, but we don't really necessarily fit into. And it makes Joan invisible. So we see the emotional labor and microaggressions that are as common among femmes today as they were back when that was filmed. So we're seeing Joan have these dreams. It opens on a dream where she is simply just following her husband through the woods. Like, she is behind him. He's not paying attention to her. He is going through these branches and thistles, not concerned at all that they are thwacking her in the face. And by the time they finish their walk through the woods and finally sit down, she is bloodied and messy, and he doesn't seem to care. So we see all of that, and it's really not until she goes to a party and starts talking to her friends, and her friends say, hey, this woman, Marion, just moved in across the street, and she's really into witchcraft. Like, she really believes it, and it's like a religion. Who knew? And Joan becomes really interested in this, and we see her slowly start to call herself a witch after meeting Marion. And so she ends up going to having a little party at her house with her 19-year-old daughter, her daughter's professor, and her friend Shirley. Shirley is very bored with her life and really shows us the typical hysterical housewife. She's getting drunk off her ass. She's saying she needs, you know, something that's not so boring. She needs change. And so finally, Joan's daughter's boyfriend, who's a fucking professor, says to Joan, she's got life in her. She's just too damn uptight to do what she wants to do with it. And then proceeds to tear up a cigarette to make it look like a joint so that he can trick Shirley into acting more of a fool. And then, so there we see, okay, well, you're too uptight. Why don't we just get you to loosen up? Ha ha, you got too loose and now you're a fucking bitch. So that just annoyed the fuck out of me. And then we see that purposeful humiliation of Shirley. And, you know, at the end of it, Shirley freaks out on Greg. And Greg ends up saying, you know, you're just so uptight and God, you're just going out of control. What's wrong with you? And then she learns that it wasn't actually weed, and gets even more angry. So we see this constant gaslighting throughout the film, and it's unfortunately incredibly realistic. And to me, that makes it all the more horrifying. And so we see also the conditioning of the women in the film to believe they're infantile and to repress those emotions that are bubbling inside from just swallowing all of this pain all of these years, and to avoid appearing hysterical. It's only after, at the end, when Joan ends up killing her husband, that she is initiated into Marion's coven, and she regains her confidence and receives compliments on her appearance, aka youth. She still, however, at the end of the film, Mrs. Mitchell, or Jack's wife, which, you know, just a perfect ending to just a clusterfuck. But yeah, I thought that was a great depiction of hysterical women, and I honestly kind of think of it as in a positive light, because to me I was like, good for her. My other film is All Cheerleaders Die from 2013. So this rebel girl, she is a queer girl, yay. She signs up the group of cheerleaders when she joins the team to help her take down this asshole captain of the high school football team. They end up getting into an altercation with the captain of the football team, and the girls get run down off the road and are killed in a river. And luckily, the main character, Maddie, her ex-girlfriend, Lena, is a witch. And so she finds all the cheerleaders' bodies in the lake or the river, and heals them and brings them back to life. And so the next day, they wake up and they realize, oh, snap, we're zombies. And so we see them go through all of this rigmarole of figuring out how to harness that power and how to take down the bad guys. And so, you know, especially Lena, being the witch of the group, she unfortunately is so annoying. I mean, to me, in that movie, because she is depicted as this like banshee of a woman. She's constantly screaming and crying and being just too much. And it is I thought that was just like the perfect depiction of how witches and how women and how women who are different, you know, different from, you know, the typical cheerleader or the popular girl, the straight girl, they are automatically written off as different or as crazy.
So Lauren, you actually brought an article to the table that I thought was really interesting. And so I wanted to find out if you could introduce that to us.
Yeah, so JSTOR is my jam, right? And in trying to do some research for this panel, I came across this article that was published in American Quarterly in 2000 called The Race of Hysteria, Over Civilization and the Savage Woman in the Late 19th Century, Obstetrics and Gynecology. So basically, the main meat of this article is basically saying how non-white women that are also non-American women, the hysteria was pinpointed as from being over-civilized, right? So the argument here is we have taken the savage from their native lands and brought them into the world. And because of this overstimulation, they're hysterical because they don't know what to do. And a quote that I liked from here was, yet if the distinction between civilized and savage seems incoherent from the distance of an intervening century, it was not fluid nor unimportant. The medicine and science of the savage accomplished conceptually what was elusive in actuality, a tidy scheme that defined hierarchically arranged places in the social order for different races. This article really does put the emphasis on perception. And we've talked a little bit about how, you know, it's all in the perception of this male doctor or the men in your life to determine whether you as a woman are hysterical or not hysterical, right? And that's why I picked the films that I picked, because I think that The Wailing and Kirinenko are two very bright, shining examples of that. Because in The Wailing, right, the two characters I kind of wanted to focus on that have this bright and shiny light of her hysterical perception are the ghost and the daughter. The daughter was the young woman that was possessed the entire film, right? And I think that in these situations of possession, when it comes to children, specifically little girls, it's always kind of brushed off in the beginning when the behavior changes, right? And it goes back to that notion of like PMSing or having an attitude. And it's never like, oh my God, what's wrong? Like, let's address this right now. It's like, oh, where's the good little girl I raised? Fix your attitude, get it together. And it's never addressed, especially in horror and possession, until it's too late, until it's like The Exorcist and we're tied to a bed, or, you know, in The Wailing sense, until we've murdered our parents in the kitchen. So it was ignored. It's always ignored until all this death and destruction happens, right? And I feel like there's a form of like gaslighting to an extent, because as a person in your own body, you know when something is wrong. And a lot of the times in The Wailing, the daughter tried to advocate for herself and say, something is not right with me. And it was always brushed off to the point of, you're just having a bad day. You know, tomorrow will be better. You'll figure it out.
It's interesting that you called all that out, because like one of the things I noticed about the film when I had watched it was the fact that the father is just like constantly sobbing over like his little girl and like the way that she was not being the way that she is and what's going on with her. Like, obviously he fears for her and her life, but like a lot of his emotions seem to derive from the like, my sweet little girl. And there's a lot of flashbacks to her as her sweet little self.
But I think that's in relation to him, right? As a possessive, right? Like, where is my
Yeah, child? Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah,
that's
yeah.
That, yeah, so, and I think that's super interesting that you called it out from, like, her perspective, and then I'm thinking about how we're shown his perspective throughout the film and a lot of his emotions and trauma come from this, like, where's my sweet little girl place?
Yeah, I mean, because and they're all like that, right? Because even The Exorcist is from, like, the priest's perspective and the mother's perspective. No one ever really figures out how these girls are feeling in the midst of being possessed. Even though it's all about like like their pain and their trauma and the trauma they inflict on other people. And even like the ghost character, right? Throughout the entire film, it was never determined if she was good or evil in this like super black and white sense of the word. And the folklore of the woman in white has a lot of different interpretations, but it's always like a woman who was violently abused to the point where she died and then is kind of around either for revenge or for like a warning for other people. And because the other men in this town, specifically this like fake shaman character, pointed the finger at her and was like, no, she's evil. And it was only because she was a woman. It was only because she was a spirit. And it was only because there's this one lore that's like, she was brutally assaulted and then died and then is out for revenge. So because she threatens this male hierarchy, she must be evil. And because of that, right, we kind of get to this deterioration at the end. But I think that that perspective kind of spread the moniker of hysteria onto the character. Because for the audience, too, like the first time I watched this movie, I was like, oh, she has to be evil, right? Because she's threatening these men. But then you watch it over and over again, you're like, wait a minute. That's not right. That's not okay.
Right. Like by the end, I was like, oh, no, she's not the evil. It's all a trick. So luckily, and I only picked up on it because I watched that movie in three parts because it's long.
It's so long. So the second film, I feel like not a lot of people have seen it. I watched this in grad school because I was lucky enough to have a professor that was really, really into J-horror and film history. So Kuren Echo is a ghost story about these two women in feudal Japan who are assaulted by 17 samurai. They come into their home, they eat all their food, they assault them, they burn down their home. And then these two women kind of become cat people, like think Scooby-Doo on Zombie Island cat people. And it's the same woman in white trope. And basically what happens is they have a scheme, right, where they lure samurai back to their home and then they kill them. And it's this pact that they made with like the devil or the evil figure or whatever, that to seek revenge for what was done to them, they will kill all the samurai that they can. And so if that was it, if that's just the story that was told, you're like, well, yeah, this makes sense. Get revenge, girl. You got it. Like, this is, yes. But as the story continues, because it's in the world of the samurai or the people in the position of power, right? The entire town is now like, oh, there's this ghost problem. And as we get to know them and see them and the protagonist, as it were, comes into play, the women are really painted as these like bitter, emotional women that can't let the past go. Because once that event happens in the beginning of the movie, they never directly talk about it again, right? Because they've been asked over and over again, who are you? How did you die? What happened? And it's just like, oh, yeah, no, the samurai, we hate them. And they never explicitly say what happened to them. They never hold to account the trauma that was enforced onto them. So they're angry, they're crying, they're upset. But it's always to be like, well, what's wrong with you? Samurai are great. Why would you hate them? This is stupid, right? And it's all of the blame and the responsibility to be like the quote unquote better person or whatever you want to call it is placed back onto these women. And we see them cry, we see them in pain. And it's always trying to gloss over their emotions because it's like, well, no, that's not an excuse to become a demon and kill people. And it's this weird and beautifully shot film that kind of makes you question what a support system is and how a community can support you. And then how do you hold people accountable for the pain and the trauma that they cause without putting all of that responsibility onto the woman in which the trauma was placed?
My first one is Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. And the plot is essentially, you know, Elvira is a TV horror host, and she gets sexually harassed by the guy who owns like the TV network. So she quits. And she was going to go to Vegas, but then found out that she is going to inherit some unknown fortune from this great aunt of hers. So she goes to Falwell, Massachusetts, which I thought was great, and finds that this town is just full of like very puritanical, like mind your values types of people. And she inherits this estate from her great aunt Morgana, and this cookbook, which she comes to find is actually a spell book that her mother used. She comes from a long line of witches. She's got this dog who turns out to be her familiar. And of course, the entire town hates her. They think she's too fast, too loose, too goth, too everything. And they end up capturing her and convicting her of witchcraft and literally tie her to a stake and try to burn her. But she's able to summon a rainstorm from her family spell book that kind of puts out the fire. She's able to banish her evil great uncle to, I guess, what would be hell. And that's kind of her whole thing. And I thought it was really, I don't know, I think it's cool. Just like I thought the witch was cool. You know, it's someone, well, not just like the witch, it's different vein. But, you know, Elvira is very much exactly how she wants to be. She dresses and speaks and acts exactly how she wants. And it turns out that that is the exact opposite of how most people come to imagine the proper woman to look and behave. She's very strong and funny and opinionated, and she ends up saving the day. And I think that's something that could be, you know, looked up to. I do think it's been a while since I saw the ending. I think she ends up, you know, obviously the youths there all really love her because, you know, she brings like technicolor into this like gray world. But it's really neat. I think it's really cool. It's a great positive depiction of someone using these powers to save the day and a woman, you know, just like being her authentic self. And for this next topic, I'm not going to go too far into it because A, it's still, in my opinion, fairly new, and B, it would be way too long, but the Fear Street trilogy came to mind for me. You know, there is a ton of witchcraft in there and a ton of strong female leads, great women saving the day, great queer women saving the day, completely separate, great kills, some really interesting stuff in there. But really, when I think about hysteria, I think of oppression. It's a way of keeping women and other marginalized people down, including classes. And Fear Street really looks at, you know, a class difference, a class war almost. And I think it's really interesting. You know, we see for centuries this like really evil, terrible family keeping the town under their control. And then these great young kids save the day. I think it's really admirable the way that they kind of portrayed everything.
Well, I'm definitely a big fan of Fear Street. I know we've talked about that. And you definitely highlighted all the points about Fear Street that I am super into, from the strong and very positive representation for a queer story. Great stories when it comes to women. And then when it comes down to... once we get that whole backstory, and a lot of this was just like about a man and for his namesake, basically like doing all these awful things to be in power and retain power. And then like what happens to Seraphir, for example, in the film is really interesting. And like that echoes a lot of what we've been talking about today. Okay, now it's time for our Q&A segment where we have a few folks that have submitted questions to our panel. Danny wants to ask everyone on the panel today, you know, what are some new femme and non-binary witch or magic practitioners in media that you thought would be interesting to highlight? Is there any representation, either positive, negative, etc.? And what does a future you'd wish to see look like or feel like for those characters?
I would love to see more non-white covens and witches and like groups of magical beings, because I feel like that's a space sometimes that is not accessible to Black and brown people. Even though like a lot of the witches I know in real life are Black and brown people. I don't have any like super specific references of like new media and stuff that I've seen.
And I think, and I don't want to talk over you when it comes to this, there's a lot of representations of witches of color that are stereotypical in horror cinema, but maybe not representations of like a modern day witch of color. And I wanted to get your perspective on that.
Yeah, because I feel like the only witch of color that I rock with is The Craft. I feel like she's like the one that's kind of a whole person to me anyway, or somebody that I could like see myself in realistically. I feel like everyone else is very like one dimensional or what is it, static.
Yeah, I'd also like to see more trans and non-binary witches, because obviously in real life witches are not determined by gender, and I don't want to see like the gender essentialist idea that woman equals witch, or that, you know, AFAB equals witch. So I know that in The Craft Legacy, there's a trans witch, I think. I have not seen the movie yet, which, you know, is ridiculous of me.
So there is a trans witch played by a trans actress.
Yes, yeah, which I would love to see more of that. Get rid of the idea that, you know, this gender essentialist witch idea, have more trans witches. That's what I would like to see.
One of the interesting things in The Craft Legacy, there's a comment made when the coven, I think, comes together for the first time and they're talking about where their power is derived from. And someone specifically mentions the uterus, and the character who is trans says, well, not all of us, because you don't need to have a uterus to be a woman in this case. So, in any case, really, as we continue to evolve and understand these things about gender. So I thought that was an interesting comment in the film. I do recommend, I just watched it again for the second time, and definitely recommend it.
So can we talk about the chilling adventures of Sabrina and how annoying Sabrina is? Because that is not, that is very stereotypical. It's very kitschy. And I understand that that's probably the point of the series, but I think
it's because it's so true to the comic books, to be honest with you.
Yeah. That's true. But I would love to see messy witches. As a witch myself, who is just a hot mess, I would love to see, you know, witches who have real world problems, like struggling with mental health, struggling with addiction, you know, dealing with abuse in ways that we haven't really seen before. And seeing those real life struggles mixed in with the practice of witchcraft, I think a more realistic depiction. I don't know how exciting it would be, but I think it would help a lot in furthering the humanization of witches and women in general, femmes in general. I apologize.
Well, when I think about the depiction of Nancy Downs in The Craft, for instance, like Nancy turns to witchcraft because of the trauma and abuse that she experiences at home. And then she is unfortunately seduced by the power of witchcraft. And the power right. that she is given.
And then she goes crazy,
turns
right?
into the hysterical, chaotic woman by the end of the film. So it's an interesting depiction. And there's both a lot that is, I think, good about it and a lot that is also bad about it. And it comes full circle a little bit in Craft Legacy, Jessica. So that's just an interesting character for me, because Nancy is not all bad and Nancy is not all good. And so I think it's like a well-rounded witch.
That's another point. I really love The Craft and the shop owner. You know, the thing she says is magic is neither black nor white, because nature is neither. And to me, that is just the most realistic depiction of witchcraft that I have seen to date, I believe.
Also, can we get more camp witches? Have y'all seen Teen Witch? Just to change the vibe for like 5 minutes. Teen Witch is great.
Oh my God. Are we talking about Teen Witch from the 80s, 1987, to compete with Michael J. Fox's wonderful also film, Teen Wolf?
Top that.
I actually just rewatched it the other night and I was talking about it. I was like, man, I just love this film, even though it's like fucking ridiculous. And the fact that it was created as like a female answer to Teen Wolf, and of course written by men. But yeah, great film. I mean, it's great and super campy. So we also have a question from Kat Benstead, who is the co-editor, co-editor-in-chief of Hear Us Scream. So what positive representations have you seen of women in horror over recent years? And have you noticed a departure from hysterical women? And they'd love to know what positive representations of women in witchcraft you have recognized in horror cinema and other media. So I think we can even just focus more on like women in horror in general and a departure from the hysterical.
I think the most recent Halloween movies have been kind of in that vein. I love 2018. I thought it was awesome. And like the entire movie is spent thinking about how Laurie Strode is this like hysterical, crazy old woman who like is a recluse because of this thing she perceives as dangerous, although everyone else thinks it's not a danger. But she comes into her power. What was the line she said? It was like a chill line. Giving chills, not like cool chill. But like, you know, when it's not that her house is this cage, but it's a trap that she's been waiting to catch Michael in. I think that was super positive, super empowering. You had all these generations of women. The new Scream franchise coming out is great. It's always been great and empowering for women. I think I have high hopes. I have high hopes for heroines and getting away from, or at least flipping the hysteria on its head.
Yeah, I would agree. And just, I personally loved the new Scream film. People had, I know, really mixed reactions to it, but I thought it was great. And for me, I was like, oh, this doesn't seem like an ending. It seems like a beginning. And lo and behold, still in theaters, here comes Scream 6 because we demanded it, I think.
Yes, to Scream 6. I'm very excited. Kat asked this question on Twitter and I answered it there, but Shining Veil is just coming out on Stars, and it stars Courtney Cox, Greg Kinnear, and Mira Sorvino. And Courtney Cox's character, and I don't know if it's just because I can relate really well to it, probably, but she is this form, she's an alcoholic, she is a former sex addict, she is trying so hard to get her act together and be this like perfect stay-at-home mom and write her novel and help the kids out, and they just moved into this big old mansion because she, you know, had an affair back in their old town and they had to get away. And she's struggling so hard to keep up and to adjust, and her reputation has followed her from this past town. And so you see this human side of her, and you can just, despite all of this stuff that she is carrying with her, you see these flashes of a genuinely good person who is doing her best. And I can't get enough of that.
S. McGee, how do you all feel about the narrative of witches today versus yesteryears? And do you believe it has gotten better or worse? I think it's gotten better in current cinema, but yeah, well, like we still see those trends, but also there's a lot more of a films that feel like they're feminist or are focused on like female power.
I do think that it's better than it was, like in terms of representation, in terms of overall storytelling. I think Fear Street is a really shining example of like the story and showing what actually happened versus the myths that are created from society, right? I think that, of course, there's always more ground to cover in terms of how do we get this full and robust experience and how do we show different things. I also am a proponent of like taking those really terrible things and subverting them just to see what happens. I'm also a proponent of like, okay, let's take this trope and like play it out, but switch out the characters and see what happens. I think that's the good thing about horror in general, because I know that we were just talking about Scream and Halloween, and it's like there's this baked in idea that we're gonna do this again and see what comes of doing it again. And I think that this trope, with its gaining in popularity over the past couple of years, I hope that that happens, where there are these remakes and redos and retries just to kind of see what comes of playing within this idea of witches and witchcraft and folk horror and what hysteria means and doesn't mean, depending on who's looking at it.
I definitely agree with Lauren. I also think that, yes, witchcraft representation in media has gotten better and has improved over the years and is in a better place now. However, I do think that with witchcraft specifically, we have to be careful, or creators have to be careful, in the girl boss trap of, you know, making these, you know, like you said, faux feminist films that are really just, you know, giving sassy white girls magic fingertips or whatever.
I enjoyed the way you put that. Sassy fingertips. Yeah. Thanks everyone for being here. If you want to submit a question, look out for our tweets on Twitter from @slayaway with us. You'll have opportunities to submit Q&A questions to our other panels coming up. And thanks again to all of our amazing guests today.
Thank you, EL.
Yes, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for slaying away with us. Until next time, stay spooky.